Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 2. Coming up on this show, we've got combat weaponry of the Astral Realm, the sound of Mantis Mines, and the Acorn Violation. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I don't know which one of those headlines to comment on. Let's go with the we'll go with the Acorn Violation. What's that?
Being violated by an acorn. It's not good.
I would imagine it wouldn't be.
Not a pretty situation.
Who's getting violated and how by an acorn?
We're about to find out. Sorry the show's a little bit late. It was unavoidable yesterday. We had some rolling blackouts, storms.
Have we moved to a third world country?
Storms for the past couple of days. Driving home last night was treacherous.
You almost died.
Treacherous. Because all the streetlights are out. It's really dark. Country roads.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty fast sweeping right-hand bend on the way home, you know, past the Christian school down there.
Yep.
And I'm really tired. There's no light. I've got my, you know, high beams on. And I swing around the corner and there's just green in front of me. Just a forest, like I'm suddenly in Jurassic Park. And I realize a massive tree has fallen across the entire road. So I've got to slam on the brakes, wet road.
Oh, no.
Just make it.
What did you do?
Thank God to the Brembos. I managed to get around. Like, I just, it was like Fast and Furious. I'm like drifting around.
Drifting around
this tree at 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah, it's dangerous. Like, it's just whatever these storms have been, it was exactly the same. Not as much like big trees driving home, but there was just stuff all over the ground. And
yeah.
It was wet and just like no power.
My driveway looked like an army of Bigfoot had just run through it. There's sticks and branches and just crap everywhere. And of course, when I pull into my driveway, because everyone else is asleep, you just hear this like all the way to the garage.
Why?
Because there's a freaking branch wedged into the bottom of my car. And the only way I could get it out this morning, you know those
country living.
You know those kids' toys, those grabber arms?
Yeah.
My son's got one, so I wake him up in the morning. I'm like, son, I need your grabber arm.
Why did you wake him up? Why did you just take it?
Oh, he was already awake. So I get this grab, and I'm on my stomach, reaching under the car with this kid's toy to pull out this branch from the storms last night. So we're back here.
So we're now, here now on a Saturday morning.
Now that we've got power to start the show. Thanks for your patience. I'm looking at this book called The Seventh Dead. It's by Brian Short. It's a bit of a memoir. And I wanted to cover it because it's full of high strangeness that seemed to converge on this in this really weird place. Forewarning, it doesn't really have a conclusion. I need you to listen along and try and help me figure out what the hell is going on.
Oh, okay. All right, we can do that.
We need some kind of theories about what's happening to this guy. It involves acorns and much worse things.
What could be much worse than an acorn?
Oh, much worse. And that's coming up. What have you got coming up?
Well, after we've been discussing recently the concept of guardian angels, Vardigas, doppelgangers, these sorts of things, it struck me that I'm like, these stories are really cool, but we don't really know what they are. What is it? What is the substance? Is there a universal substance that allows these things to manifest? And I wanted to dive into it in a little bit of greater detail. So I started looking around and it led me down this path of looking into some of the more out there astral travel experiences that people have had. And some people have formulated theories about a substance that exists out there that is essentially, it's a living astral substance. And it floats around and it's on the ground. And it's whenever people enter into this astral realm, it's like walking through mud sometimes. It's described by people. And what this is, though, is at the moment that it strikes a thought of some kind, and invariably these thoughts always tend to be obsessive and negative, it forms an entity. And this substance is like, some people have referred to it as a dark plasma.
Wow.
And what it does is that it essentially forms. It's not like ectoplasm, it's not vibrational energy, it's an actual physical substance in an astral realm that can form into any of these things that we talk about, like tulpas, doppelgangers, Vardigas, all this kind of stuff.
So this is something that we've long said on the show, that every thought, every single intention has intelligence.
Well, yes. I mean, it's not that the thought itself does. The thought has to collide with the substance.
Right.
And that kind of gives a life to the substance.
Yeah, it creates an entity.
Yeah, it's like, it's crazy. It's described as it being like a compost of the astral realm. And I know that sounds filthy, but essentially what it is, you know, it described the ego, right? So people have these multiple shells of themselves that kind of break down. When they pass away, that leaves those kind of zombified shells wandering around. Ultimately, they do break down because no one's giving thought to it after a period of time because everyone that knows them has also passed on. Mm. And eventually it just breaks down because it's no longer. So when it breaks down, it starts composting into the astral realm. But the problem is that from compost, new life can spring forth. And this stuff is where these thoughts and obsessions and emotions come from people can actually manifest. And this is why you have ghost sightings in places of where there's been like a violent crime take place.
Right.
Or, you know, a lot of misery where you have got terrible places. It's because this compost is fertile ground for the thoughts and intentions of the living.
I'm looking forward to
that. Yeah, it's kind of crazy stuff. And also there's a lot of explanations as to why you're fat. So, not you particularly, just as in general, why we have fat upon ourselves is could have something to do with the compost in the astral realm.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Let's go into Brian C. Short's memoir, The Seventh Dead. This is a recent release. I just picked it up on Kindle. So let me just skip ahead to some of his memories because this is really setting the stage for the strange path in his life. And again, I want you to help me understand what the hell is going on.
Okay.
So he says it's a summer day, late afternoon. He remembers being about 4 or 5 years old. And he knows this because he shortly after this experience started walking to kindergarten in the morning. So he's very, very young. It's a warm, sunny day outside and he goes to the front door. He wants to play outside and he stops at the porch and he stops suddenly like at the threshold of leaving the house. And something tells him, he says, not a voice, but just this inarticulate knowing. Something tells him he needs to raise his index finger on his right hand up into the sky.
Oh, okay. Well,
kind of like when you lick your finger and you're trying to sense which way the wind's going. He does this. He should put his finger up in the air and wait. So he does this. It's like an instruction, he says, like a script or a program. And he didn't occur to question it. He wasn't even aware what was happening. He just puts his finger up and it feels like his idea, but it's not. And he stops there on the porch, puts his finger up to the sky and waits. And after just a single moment, an acorn drops straight down from the sky and wraps itself around his finger. And he looks and it's got like a stiff brown shell and it's got like a mouth on the bottom of it, exactly finger sized. It fits perfectly over his finger.
It's got a mouth on it.
Well, it's got like an opening underneath it and it goes on his finger and it starts sucking his finger like and it actually bites him. It bites him.
You get an acorn on your finger and you're just like, oh, this is fascinating. You're like, get it off.
He's just a kid. He doesn't know what's going on. He's never really seen an acorn before. And he says there was a tooth or a thorn or a stinger or something inside it that pierced the skin on his index finger. And once it had done that, it popped off his finger and flew away.
Did it take something from him?
Well, it jabbed him with something. Now, at the time, again, he didn't really even know what an acorn was. He just knew that the general shape and size of them. And he was like, oh, an acorn, that's weird. But he remembers when he did start walking to school for kindergarten, he saw these acorns on the ground. And he remembers thinking, oh, that's weird. Those are dead acorns because they're not flying and they're not intelligent. They must be dead ones. Because he just thought that's what acorns do. They fly around and they have intelligence. So
I guess when you're young, it would make sense that you just think that that's what happens.
Yeah. He's just a kid.
Yeah.
And that's not the only strange memory from childhood. These are memories, he said, that really should be dreams. But they're not. They're just highly strange. So somewhere between the age of 5 and 8, he has this other memory. He had found the body of a dead bumblebee in the corner of the living room windowsill. And he said near the door, like near the opening of the window, there was this little section in the corner it's like an access point to the hinge of the window or something. It must be, it's like a sliding window or something. And he said, you could open this, right? It's this little access point. And he opens this and there's a dead bumblebee in there. And for some reason, this dead bumblebee fascinates him. Like the stillness of its death, its unchanging nature over time, he writes. It became a daily ritual for this kid to check on the bumblebee corpse just before dinner time, before the family was called to the table. And he did this for about a week. So every day, his mom would be like, dinner's ready. And he'd quickly run to the windowsill, open this little hatch and just look at this dead bumblebee.
It's not like it's going anywhere though.
And make sure it's there. And he didn't understand why this was important. He didn't really understand what was interesting about it, but he just kept on doing it every day. And it seemed really important to him to do it. Like, it's just something he had to do every day to check on this dead bumblebee. He says there was less of an obsessive quality than it may sound because during the day he never thought about the bumblebee. It wasn't like it was this obsession where he's like, oh, I've got to check that bumblebee. It was just at this particular time every day he had to check on this bumblebee. And then that was it. He wouldn't think of it again. But on one occasion, this was the last time he checked on it, he ran over quickly before dinner time. He opens a little hatch to check on this little dead bumblebee. And he finds that it's changed. It's no longer an actual dead bumblebee, but it's now an oversized fake bee made out of fabric and stuffing. It's been replaced by a weird facsimile of a bumblebee. He says the abdomen was thick and fuzzy. It had felt wings that were stitched on around the head and the abdomen. There was this ring of black felt and was sticking out like a ruff, like someone had created it.
Had his mother seen him going to it? And obviously she went to check what he was doing, threw it out, replaced it.
No, think about this scenario. It's a tiny little bee and it's been replaced by this intricate felt handmade copy. The eyes are overlarge with irises and pupils and concentric circles of coloured felt layered one on top of each other, yeah, glued like onto the face.
Someone's gone to a lot of effort.
It's a supreme amount of effort for something that doesn't even make any sense. Like, why would anyone do this? And he says the most ridiculous thing of all is that on this felt, fluffy fabric bee was a little king's crown. Askew on its head.
Crown.
It's
the king bee?
What is going on? And he was furious that his bee corpse had been replaced by this offensive felt copy. He says, this was my bee. It was my secret and someone had messed with it. Now, he's sure that his sister had done this. But his sister's just a kid as well. She's like a year or two older than him. And the felt and the way it's made is so like professionally machine done. Like, it's so perfect. But you can tell it's made of felt.
Mm.
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense. Someone had stolen reality itself out from under him. That's what it felt like. It was like this weird gaslighting. Why would anyone gaslight a six-year-old? Why would this happen? Very, very strange.
That's the thing. I mean, why would you go to that kind of effort? It's just the only thing I can think of, you know, further to the argument before, was that maybe someone in the family had seen him doing this every day. It's a bit odd, a child doing it every day. Maybe they got rid of it because, like, oh, they don't want a dead corpse of a bee in the house, and then went to the shops
and bought a tiny felt bumblebee with a crown on it.
It's saying that the thought of actually going and see, like, if I said to you today, go out and buy a felt bee somewhere, you'd be like, what?
Or what do you need the felt bee for? Oh, my child's looking at a bee corpse every day.
My point is, you wouldn't be able to find one.
Exactly. Yeah. So again, this is a memory that should be a dream, but he 100% knows it's real. It's very firm in his mind.
Is he having trouble, though, differentiating between dreams and reality? Is that what's going on here?
Well, this is just a handful of these. right? It's not like he has fantasies interwoven with everything else. It's just a couple of these weird memories.
But that happens to children when they're young. Like, they have difficulty when they're older, and obviously he's recalling this when he's older. Is he having difficulty differentiating between something that really happened and something that was a dream?
If I didn't know the rest of the story, I'd say yes.
Yeah, okay.
So the other memory is from a few years later. This is around second or third grade. He's about 9 years old. And he had a friend from school named Mark. And once in a while, this friend Mark would come over to his house to play. And Brian said, I don't remember ever going to Mark's house or having any particular friendly feelings towards him. I don't even remember how we met or what we even enjoyed about each other's company. So his point in saying that is that this was kind of a friendship that was arranged. Like maybe the parents knew each other and, you know, they would bring over Mark to play. They weren't actually friends. They just were together playing.
Yeah.
And the memory is from them playing in the basement of his family home. They had this big recreation area for kids downstairs. And while they were playing, at one point, his mother came down the stairs carrying a plate of sliced apples. She had a snack for them. And Mark and Brian, they took a slice each. And without saying anything, his mother went to sit in this nearby rocking chair as if to watch over them while they played and ate their apple. And she didn't really do anything. She just kind of sat in the chair, didn't really seem to be watching them that closely. And he says, this is when things became very, very strange. As his mother sat in the chair saying nothing, Brian and Mark suddenly find themselves standing on opposite corners of the room, facing each other, holding their apple slices in front of them. Like he's been suddenly teleported. But there's something highly ritualized about it. Like they're standing up straight, facing each other, as if it's orchestrated, like something's about to happen.
But placed, obviously, back for a reason.
Yeah, like they have specific roles on a chessboard, he says. That's what it's like.
Mm.
Then throughout the room, this gray cloud starts to form, this weird swirling around them. He says it's like a vapor or a smoke, and the room itself starts to become vague and then disappears around them, except for this clear tunnel or tube between Mark and Brian, this connection between them in this swirling smoke. It's about 2 or 3 feet in diameter, and around the edges of this swirling tube, it's like looking into the center of a cyclone and around the edges is this weird oily substance.
Ooh. Is it iridescent? Is it kind of like oil on water?
He doesn't really say. It's just forming this tunnel between them. And while this is happening, they're just standing there motionless, facing each other like statues waiting for something. And as if given a cue they'd both been waiting for, they start to walk towards one another. And he says, I remember our expressions were utterly blank, and I can't remember feeling anything at all other than one of total abstraction, like we were performing parts that we had been instructed to do mechanically, as if we were automatons. He said, after taking a few steps forward, we both then took a step or two up in the air, maybe 4 inches, and there seemed to be a ramp or a platform we were now standing on. Now, he knows, obviously, in this room, there's nothing. There's just an open recreation area for the kids. There's no ramp in there. But by now, they're walking in this tunnel. He can't see his legs because it's below this weird vapor. He's just standing in this tunnel. And they're slightly elevated, walking towards each other, and they just march towards each other like two robots.
To do what?
No idea. And he says, Mark, I now saw, had his apple slice in his mouth. This was perfectly clear. One end of it clenched between his teeth and the other end kind of sticking out. Perhaps, he says, I had done the same with mine, though I don't actually remember. He says, it seems, however, that biting into our apples was the thing that started the whole experience.
It was like a trigger moment.
After walking towards each other and crossing past each other, we stepped down off the opposite side of this ramp or bridge onto the carpeting of the floor. These strange clouds and mist then disappeared, and anything beyond this point is lost to me. He said if my mother had noticed anything, she never said anything. Yet it seems like her part was just as prescribed as ours. Like it was just, She was staring off into space like that was her role, to sit in that chair. He said the entire episode has the quality of a ritual to it, like a Freemasonic initiation, though one even more bizarre, more abstract and completely spontaneous, in which we, the dramatis personae, each had our role, significant and symbolic, if limited in scope.
And what the hell is going on?
That's where the memory ends.
What is that?
So I'm like, what the? Acorns on the fingers, felt bees in the windowsill, and then some swirling ritual in the living room. What the hell is going on? Again, I'm pleading with someone out there. I'm pleading with you, Aaron.
Well, I have...
Help me understand what's going on.
I have a theory, but it will tie in with what's coming up with the Plus extension, but it sounds like they've entered into the astral realm. Because one thing that's described, and this was by... Who wrote Astral Dynamics? I've got it here in front of me. So this is by Robert Bruce, of course. Robert Bruce wrote a book called Astral Dynamics, and I'm going to go into that later on, but essentially he was describing the way that people enter into the astral realm.
Yeah.
And there was something that was described by Robert Munro, and it was like, when you go into this space, the reason why people see tunnels, right, is because Robert Munro described these different, they are seemingly, even though they're astral, physical rings, like they're different rings that you kind of move through. And when you move from one ring to the next, so from our reality to the next ring,
yeah,
it causes what appears to be a tunnel. Like,
really?
It actually looks like a tunnel. You get this tunnel effect, and it's like you're passing through a mist of some kind, which is all this, you know, etheric kind of mess that's around you, and it has this tunnel effect. So what he's describing with that tunnel, even though it was him to the other kid, but the mistiness and everything else, it sounds like he was entering into an astral state.
That's very interesting. You might be onto something. Well, we continue with the weirdness, because in 1980, his family was quite well off, and His father bought a house on Whidbey Island. It just had one proper bedroom, high ceilings and a loft where you could sleep in as well, and an extra room that another person could sleep. But it was this beautiful spot, sweeping view out over the water. It was on the edge of a bluff. And his parents had gone up there for a weekend trip in the summer of 1981. Brian went with them, of course. And he's just, I think he's 14 at this stage. And their family friend, Stu, who's a woman for some reason with the name Stu, came along as well. And, you know, she slept in the loft and he took the spare bedroom upstairs. And he says that night when they were staying in this holiday house, he woke up at 2:30 in the morning needing to use the toilet. And since there was only one bathroom downstairs, he had to basically sneak past Stu, who's asleep in the loft, to get down to the main level.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets downstairs, he crosses the living room, and he looks at the, because they've got these huge floor-to-ceiling windows looking out over the water. It's beautiful. He takes a look outside, and there's this luminous orange smear in the sky. Again, it's like 2:30 in the morning, but there's this glowing orange striation flowing through the sky, and it's forming this discrete shape of a bent horizontal trapezoid. It's like a few miles high, several miles wide. And he's awake enough to understand that there's something seriously bizarre in the sky. But he says, I seemed at pains to think anything about it. Like he just sees this bizarre Rorschach test in the sky and then goes onto the bathroom where he relieves himself. He comes back out to again find this vast glowing shape had changed. What had been a huge swathe was now condensed into a much smaller, more contained, utterly precise shape in the sky. This crazy light show was now in the shape of a bracket. It was like almost like a capital L in the sky. And he could see that it was moving. It's drifting slowly towards the north, at the same time gradually lowering. And after staring at this, again, in utter neutrality, like no emotion at all, he loses interest and simply goes back to bed. And as far as he can tell, he just fell into a deep sleep, untroubled, and that was it.
There's always an odd feeling of like the abduction kind of scenario happening here with this guy.
Especially with him seeing something bizarre in the sky. Yes. And just going, eh, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Meh.
The next morning, the four of them are sitting for breakfast, using a card table near the windows. And something about the night before troubled him, because after he'd seen this thing in the sky, for some reason he went to drink a glass of water. Like, this seemed like a smart thing to do. He drinks half a glass of water and he left the glass of water on the bench.
Mm.
And when he's at breakfast with his parents and the family friend Stu, he sees the half-drunk glass of water and he remembers, oh, that's right, I was up last night and saw something weird. So he starts telling everyone about what he'd seen. And this gets no response from his parents. They're like, okay, whatever, yeah, yeah. Kids seeing things.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But he looks over at their family friend, Stu. Her eyes are wide open, like bug-eyed, and her mouth is dropped as in, what the fuck?
Why?
She didn't say anything he said, but it was obvious that she'd been seriously bothered by him mentioning this, like severely disturbed by it, but she didn't say a thing. He said, I remember nothing more of the rest of the time we spent at the cabin that trip, but I'm pretty sure that was both the first and last of anything that was said about it. I'm not sure I wasn't going to mention it again. So years later, in the 2010s, Brian's now in his 50s, and he's seeing a therapist for general life stuff, right? And nothing to do with any of these events. But he starts mentioning some of these events eventually to this therapist, you know, just in the way I've described them to you now. And this therapist doesn't want to handle them directly. This therapist says, I need you to see a colleague of mine who's experienced with people that have transpersonal experiences, people that have spiritual moments, because she recognizes these as real memories, but they could be hiding something significant.
Yes, yeah.
So she refers him to this colleague, and this colleague specializes in hypnosis. So you can see where this is going, right? Brian starts seeing this other therapist and opens up about these strange memories from his youth. In the first hypnosis session, she takes him all the way back to the acorn on the finger.
It's back to when he was five.
Yeah, so he's five, he's standing outside, he puts his finger up, and this little brown acorn comes out of the sky and starts sucking on his index finger and bites him with a stinger or a tooth or something. And as he reviews this in this hypnotic state, he has this... It's strange. He has this vision of an intersection of two kind of circles, and they morph into overlapping circles that become elongated, and he immediately recognizes them as the culturally familiar almond-shaped eyes of the often-sighted greys.
Oh, here we go.
He doesn't see anything else about the acorn. He just sees this face. And the image of the face is so vivid, he has to sketch it. Like, as soon as he gets out of this hypnosis, he just sketches this entire face with insistent clarity.
How old is he now? He said he was 60?
Oh, he's in his 50s now.
50s, right.
So he's obviously familiar with the image,
yeah.
Right?
That's what I'm wondering. Has his experiences of his childhood somehow been influenced or coloured by...
I mean, it's the 2010s.
Years of popular culture.
Everyone's seen that image.
Mm.
But why would that image come up when he's reliving this moment of an acorn landing on his finger? Why would that be associated with it? So he draws this, and then later on he does another hypnotic session with this woman. And the implication that he gets out of this session is that this memory is a screen concealing something else more traumatic behind it. So he suddenly sees himself in this scenario with his finger up in the air, but he's not on the porch anymore. He's now in a strange room, but it's a human room. It's like, it's a room from our existence. He's laid back in a dentist's chair, and it's this smallish dark room surrounded by archaic looking machines. Now, this is a really important detail. All these machines are arranged on racks and shelves across the walls, and they're all very distinctive. They have this blue-green color faceplate, and they seem like it's almost like vintage audio gear
because
they've got VU meters on them. They've got tubes. It looks like they're from the 1940s, maybe up to the 1960s. They've got Bakelite dials and just
very retro.
Imagine like a nice classy studio with really cool old gear.
Yeah.
It's just all
around.
I imagine
how warm the sound would be.
Oh, yeah. All like, while you're getting abducted. Like, the sound would be amazing. He's just seeing all this
all
gear.
All the NOS tubes, like, wow.
Yeah, all this gear everywhere. And this tone in the room is dark, dim, cramped, and there's this over-large examination light suspended above this dentist chair. But for some reason, he's just thinking about all this audio gear, this retro gear that's surrounding him. But the whole thing is like, obviously something out of a horror movie, like it's dark and scary, but it almost seems like it's done on purpose. Like it's kind of comical that it's trying to create this sense of dread. Anyway, towering over him is a gigantic bug, a giant praying mantis with an inarticulate face, he says, shaped not unlike a prototypical grey alien. The thing is, it's standing upright and it's between 8 or so feet high, and its face has the same shaped eyes as my imaginary grey, but bigger and extended around the sides of its head. Its face is almost entirely featureless except for the eyes themselves. And this giant praying mantis is leaning over him, intent upon him, and two more of the same species are hanging back in the darkness. What it was doing, he said, was taking a very long needle and inserting it into the tip of my forefinger. And conveying to me, he says, silently, the absolute power of its presence. And this is what you hear all the time in abduction cases. Mm-hmm. People talk about the horrible...
the medical experiment.
Well, the horrible weight of the intellect of these entities. They say it to a certain degree with short little grey beings, but the reports you hear of people that come across these
tall ones,
mantis-like things, they say it is just horrific to be in their presence because there's a certain power, there's like a tangible power to their mind, and it's hard to be around. It's like you're influenced by the field. This creature, he said, and as an example, he said it was extraordinary, but less because of its frightening appearance, he says it was the tangible, terrible intelligence that was emanating from it. And he knew that this needle stuck into his finger wasn't taking anything from him. It wasn't taking blood. It wasn't a syringe. He said it was actually giving me something. This is what he understood in the hypnotic state. It was implanting or injecting me with an image. A germ of an idea, he said, like a tiny seed or an egg that would grow into something more tangible later. He said it represented a level of influence, not subtle in its delivery, but very much so in its implication. And this is interesting how he describes this, because we often talk about what the influence over time of people that claim they're abducted by these entities, how it shapes their lives. He said he was being made to develop around the idea that was being implanted into him. It was like a scaffolding for the shaping of his psyche and his very being. He would respond to it as a growing organism, and it would be this influence within him, he said. These were the things I simply know as that level of mind was allowed to unfold. Like he just had this understanding in this hypnotic regression.
What could they possibly expect to create using some methodology like that?
It's a really interesting idea, though, to implant some kind of core fundamental foundation of an idea in a person, and then over time...
Well, it sounds infecting.
Yeah, like their psyche, everything about them grows around this principle, this foundation. And he gets a sense this is what they've done to him. So, again, he does another session. Like, this is obviously terrifying, the implications of it, but he keeps going with the hypnosis, and he does another session about that weird L-shaped light show in the sky at his parents' holiday home.
Was this when he had the glass of water?
Yeah. So he goes back, he goes into a hypnotic state, the therapist takes him back to this point, this night, and he realizes when he was seeing this thing in the sky, his memories of being in his bedroom, like not in his bedroom, but in his parents' house. But he realizes he was actually in this black room made of these boxy shapes. And all these boxy shapes represented actual things that should have been in the room, like the furniture, the ladder up to the loft where, you know, he and Stu slept. But it was like, what's the way to describe it? It was like this bare bones scaffolding that the simulation of his parents' holiday home was projected onto. And so because he's in a hypnotic state, he's seeing that, oh, this is what it actually looks like.
Mm.
It's just like this weird room with shapes in it, but made to look like his parents' house. And the windows that he would normally look out in his parents' holiday home are replaced by a screen.
So is it like a holographic's not the right word, but essentially it's a projection.
Yeah, it's like a holodeck. He's in this projection of his parents' holiday home.
Where is he? Is he aboard a ship?
Well,
is
he doesn't know. He's standing there looking at this screen. It's like this giant LCD screen where the cloud is, right? And he's watching it on the screen. And he's standing at these windows, which is just this screen, beside one of these giant praying mantises. And it's towering over him. And it's almost like it's reassuring him. Like it's got one of its mandibles. Not mandible. What's the name of its arm? Like an insect's arm.
I don't know, but like the clawy thing.
He's got a clawy thing on his shoulder.
Oh, I'll be like, don't touch me.
And the other foreleg is pointing, like waving towards the screen as if pay attention to this. And it's standing behind him.
Where's the bug spray when you need it?
Oh my gosh. And it's like we were simply friends in this abstracted place doing a necessary and good thing. That's what it felt like. And what was this thing they were doing? He said the projections that he was watching, this thing that he thought he saw in the sky, was conveying to him information that was, in a way, both quite deep and immediate. But this creature, he remembers it wanted him to read the light in a certain direction. Like he needed to read it from right to left. But everything that he was getting from it, like all the information was holographic, multi-layered, injected into his mind all at once. And this light, this weird L-shaped thing on the screen was alive, incredibly meaningful, but like that needle prick that he got, that imprint, it was like a seed that was active. It was like an active level of influence that was meant to take shape within him over time. It's like another layer of programming that's being injected into him. And he says it was aligning pliable elements of myself with some purpose that they had for me. I was to contain this thing inside me and be transformed by it. It was as if a brand were being burned into my mind or the substance of my soul, a symbol to signify something that was vast and inexpressible. Yet it was my job, he said, to somehow find ways to express it, and this would become my lifetime's work. So in this session, as if anticipating the therapist's question, because the therapist asked this a moment later, is it just you and the mantis being in this weird room? He then becomes aware of Stu's presence. Remember the female family yep. friend? And he looks over, and she's beyond the mantis being. She's stretched out on the far end of the floor near the corner of the windows, lying on her stomach, stretching out with her arm, trying to reach him with this look of absolute terror on her face. Her fear is so great, he said, that she seemed paralyzed from the waist down. And she's just like trying to reach out to him. Huge face in a perfect O, unable to accept what she's seeing. And he, on the other hand, is just completely at ease with it. He's like, okay, Mantis bro, yeah, absorbing all the info. This is cool. We're pals. This is great. We're working together on something, he said. But he does understand the relationship is asymmetric. He says, like, it's something being done to me, but it's not a disagreeable experience. He says, there's obviously some amount of effort to make me comfortable with the situation and the setting, and this monster standing behind me wants me to understand that it was a friend. Really?
They're never friendly.
Really?
They may pretend to be friendly, but they're wolves in sheep's clothing.
Yeah. So the therapist asks, can you ask the being why Stu is there? And he says this changes the dynamic of the scene. Like before in this regression, he's looking at something that had happened in the past. But as soon as the therapist asks this, the mantis being standing beside him moves next to him and like just slightly turns its head.
Like it's blocking it?
No, it turns its head to look at him, as in it's now aware that the question is being asked. And the scenario is now immediate. It's a real thing happening right now.
It's responding in real time.
Exactly. It's responding in real time to the therapist's question. And as it turns its head and he just very slightly sees like part of its eye, there's this like this horrible kind of brr. Like imagine the horrible movie sound effect where it's brr. Just again, and it's that the power. No, it's like the power of its intellect is overwhelming. Where just to even make slight contact with the side of its eye is going to just destroy him. Like, it's just too powerful. So all he gets is a sense that Stu, the family friend, has been placed there as confirmation. As a confirmation.
Why? But why would that matter? Because the confirmation would only come from then, like, yes, you're seeing it in the regression, but you then need to go and speak to her and say, hey, and without prompting her, have you ever seen anything unusual in that house? I mean, I guess in a way that's prompting, but how else would you ask it?
Well, it's confirmation for him because he remembers her reaction. He remembers her reaction as a kid when he told that story at the breakfast table.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I guess for him, yeah, that makes sense.
It's like the being needed to put someone there so that he understood it was real.
But then it all sounds very convoluted and drawn out. What could it possibly be trying to cause him to what understand or
he's asking the same questions. Confirmation of what?
Yeah.
What exactly happened? Again, this is why I'm asking you. Help me out here. I've been doing this show for 16 years. I don't know what's going on with this story. And he says what remains the most important thing about this event is the feature of the light itself, which again was putting something inside him. And it's been the focus of his life's work to unpack and express some of what was communicated to him. And he's done this through creative media. Like he's done writing, film, music. He says this is what consumes him. It's central to his existence, is trying to reproduce what was injected into him. So there's more, though, and it gets weirder from here. On the last day of summer break in 1984, this is another like teenage memory. This is before the beginning of his senior year at high school. He had gone foraging for blue ring and mushrooms at the local park. So he was getting into psychedelics. His sister, apparently, his older sister, took a kind of left-hand path and got into drugs. And he was kind of influenced by this and wanted to try psychedelics. So he'd been trying psychedelics a couple of times. But he wanted to grab these mushrooms and have some psilocybin. So he managed to pick a bunch of them. He took his haul back home. His parents had gone to bed. And he starts brewing them up. In the kitchen, making this really strong like psychedelic mushroom tea. And this neighborhood friend, David, who was the oldest of four brothers, lived next door, was going to drink it with him. And David was there in the kitchen standing beside him watching Brian cook up this psilocybin stew. And this is where it gets very weird. At the time, now Brian, the author here, he was still a virgin. And he said the girls at school generally found something off about him. And they guessed he was probably gay. Now, when you read through his memoir, you do get a sense, not that he's gay, that he's got autism.
Oh, okay.
Because from a very early age, he's saying things like the other kids at school seem to have some unspoken agreement about how to behave and what to do, which I never understood. And I've never really got it. And he says, I couldn't make friends like they could make friends. It was like I didn't understand the rules, which sounds like,
I mean,
autism.
He could just be socially awkward. But yeah, you're right. He also could be on the spectrum somewhere.
He just doesn't understand social cues is what it sounds like. He said he eventually learnt them, but he had to teach himself, whereas most people pick those up intrinsically. And there's other examples where you just get a sense that he's on the spectrum. So this is probably why girls think that there's something off about him, because he doesn't understand social cues like everyone else, but they just think he's gay. And he said this was humiliating because he wasn't. And he was so insecure, though. He had a really like insecure personality. He started to think that maybe they are seeing something inside me that I haven't recognized yet. Like maybe I am gay. And it turns out this guy from next door, this older kid, David, was the complete opposite. Like, he was very confident, very experienced with girls, like, you know, bragged about his sexual escapades. And he says he was also so confident in himself, he had also started experimenting with homosexuality. And he had also invited Brian to an orgy with another neighborhood youth. So, okay, where is this story going? Now, of course, Brian is so insecure. He's like, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't know. Yeah. He's just scared. He's just a scared young boy. So the point of this is to have this David guy alone in the kitchen with him.
It sounds predatory.
To take this psychedelic. It's very scary for him. Like, it's he wants to be with the cool older kid, but he's also very insecure and scared. It's just a bad situation set up, right? But they didn't end up hanging out. David, the older kid, took his drink of the psilocybin, and then he said he had to go back home for something. He didn't say what, and he said he'd be coming back, but Brian was basically left alone, which is like, great, that's fine with me. He drinks his psilocybin tea. He goes downstairs to his bedroom and shuts himself in his walk-in closet and feels like the drug coming over him. Now, he'd taken psychedelics before, and he understood that you can have bad trips, but this was a bad trip he never thought was even possible. He said the fear moved things into darker territory than he'd ever seen before. And he's starting to freak out. He's realizing this is becoming a bad trip.
Is he overdosing?
Well, you can't really overdose on psilocybin. But maybe he's taken too much or it's a stronger mushroom than he's used to, but he's high as hell. And eventually he starts hearing a knock at his window. It's probably David coming back. But he's so out of it. Like, he's so terrified, paranoid, having a bad experience. He just ignores it. The drugs are peaking. He can't stand to face another person, let alone this older, confident kid who's possibly trying to get with him. So he's just can't bear to open the window. And the knocking continues. It gets more insistent. He just ignores it. He just wants to be left alone. Finally, the knocking stops and he shuts himself further away and he's in his walk-in closet in his room. And he says, I let the shame wash over me as the psilocybin started peaking. So he curls into a fetal position. And this is where it's weird, because he says he's curling himself on his bed, but there's no bed in his walk-in closet. So, but this is his memory of curling himself in the fetal position on his bed. And then somebody came in through the closed window in his bedroom.
You mean when they went through the actual glass?
They walked through the wall and through the glass. And he said, I can only see this person's in my mind's eye, but I knew it was David. He was in his astral form and had pushed his way through my defenses and was coming for me anyway. He says, I didn't move. I could scarcely breathe. He said, I still wore my clothes, but David came in through the wall of my walk-in closet and entered me from behind. He said, there was nothing I could do to stop it. I felt a hand cupped against the back of my head as if in reassurance, and the sensation of having someone's penis inside me, it was as vivid as it was unwelcome.
This is horrific.
Now, I apologize for the graphic nature of this scene, but it is an important factor to the story.
Can I just interject? Is it a false memory of an alien abduction?
Well, he doesn't think it's anything like that. When the deed is done, the specter of David leaves, and he, think about what I just described with his insecurities. He now thinks all the fears about himself are confirmed. He thinks, not only am I weak and cowardly, but I must be gay as well, and this is the worst thing that could ever happen to me. He says, whatever has been left of my crumbling personality has been destroyed. And he said, I knew that there was no way I could live with any of this. I was going to kill myself.
Oh, it's awful.
In that moment, he makes up his mind that he's going to get in his car, drive as fast as he can into oncoming traffic. And he says, I don't care who I take out with me.
Oh, that's true.
I'm just going to do it. And he's so negative about the world. He's like, anyone I kill deserves it. So he actually gets the keys. He goes outside to his car and he's going to go through with it. But there's a hitch. He can't get in his car because David is inside his car, Astral David. And every time he goes to unlock one of the doors, Astral David pushes the lock back down. So he can't get in his car. He goes around to the other door. Astral David's like mocking him, pushes the lock back down. And he does this for like 5 minutes, and every attempt to get in the car is blocked. And baffled, standing there with his keys in his hands, he just gives up. Now, he goes into his parents' room after this. Like, he says, I do the worst thing possible. He goes into his parents' room and he's like, Mom and Dad, I took some acid and I don't know what's going on. He just starts crying.
Yeah, because that's the thing you can't rule out. As horrific as that scene was, I mean, he's on psychedelics. So this whole thing could be a hallucination.
That's what he thinks it is.
Brought about because of his anxiety.
That's what he thinks it is. He doesn't actually think that David came in to... He thinks it's all a hallucination and he's lost it and he's suicidal and he asks his parents for help and he says this is the worst thing he could have done. It's the best thing he could have done because his mother comforts him and, you know, he cries on her lap and his father starts demanding where he got the drugs from and the truth was he collected all the mushrooms himself, but he blames David. And again, it just shows his weak, cowardly character that he blames David for this. David probably just wanted to have fun, you know, knocked on the window and just went home. He's like, what the hell was that? Who knows what David's doing? David's probably at home watching a movie or something. He has no idea what's going on. Now he's the older guy that gave drugs to the kid next door. Anyway, his father is completely furious at this, and eventually word gets to David that his dad was looking for him for giving drugs. He just loses more friends. He becomes more of an outcast and he just becomes completely nihilistic. It's just a disaster, absolute disaster. So the therapist takes him back to this event and he's in this hypnotic regression. And he knew that there were various details that didn't make sense. Like he was in his walk-in closet, but he remembers curling up on a bed. That doesn't make sense. There was no bed in his closet. There was some details that just didn't match up. But the scenario he saw play out while he was in the regression was very, very different to what he actually remembers happening. Someone did melt in through the window. Someone did melt in through the closet. But he wasn't curled up on a bed or inside his closet. He was on a raised bed, face down, with his right knee bent and hips turned, being converged on by three small grey creatures. He says, we weren't in my bedroom anymore. We were in some abstract space which lacked any detail, kind of like that black room with the shapes that the mantis created. The room was all white with light coming from all directions. And these grey creatures with spindly bodies and large heads with huge black slanted eyes, two of them stood close nearby to either side of my body as the third inserted into my rectum a pale off-white dildo. One of the others bent close over me and held a hand to the back of my head, cupping the base of my skull tenderly, as if in reassurance. I feel sorry for David.
I don't believe any of this is real, though. I don't. I think what's happened with this guy, it sounds like he's a weak character.
Correct.
It sounds like he has a lot lacking in his life. But what he's described, you know what? This is the thing, the whole anal probing thing. The only time that that's really come up in abduction history is Whitley Strieber. That's the only time. It never comes up in any other report.
Jim Sparks gets a little anal probe.
Yeah, but I'm a little bit. But let's just be honest here. Like, it's very rare.
It was a trainer.
That you hear this, right? It's very rare. What I'm detecting here, I reckon this guy has built a very vivid imaginary world and his personality is weak. And so this is something for him to cling on to. It gives him some type of importance. It gives him some type of meaning in his life. And it's all coming out in this regression, which is clearly colored by this issue that he has.
Well, he doesn't...
I mean, maybe he's a repressed homosexual. I mean, what's going on? Maybe that's...
No, it doesn't seem that way because he gets married. He dates women. He doesn't have any...
There's gay people that do that.
He doesn't have any homosexual urges or experiences throughout the rest of his memoir. And it's his entire life. He doesn't necessarily disagree with you either when he's writing this. Like, for example, when the mantis first shows up and he's in that dentist chair, he writes, do I believe that I was, you know, abducted by this large praying mantis? He's like, no, I can't say that definitely happened, but I can't say it didn't either. He's just unsure. He doesn't know what these mean. And he's always toying with the idea that these are constructions in his mind. But why would his mind construct these scenarios?
Because it's
that's the question.
Because he's probably got a histrionic personality disorder or something similar. And as a result, he's been influenced by popular culture. And that's where this imagery is coming from.
Well, but there's lots of influence of popular culture. Why would this arise?
That I don't know.
So the question that the therapist gives him is, why are the beings doing this? Is it some kind of probe? Like, is it some kind of, are they taking a sample? He says, no. He says, I needed to be broken. They were doing it not for any scientific reason. Okay, or he says he needed to be broken. They were doing this to force his spirit to a point of breakage, to surrender to the worst, he says. And the presence of the being's hand on my skull, like cradling the back of his skull, was to tell him something also, something very specific, that they knew exactly what this would do to him, that the apparent cruelty was necessary, but they were ultimately concerned for his greater well-being and that this was the only way to do it.
So ETs, from other stories we've heard, know the depths, the deepest, darkest depths of human psychology. They know how to control us. They know how to create screen memories. They know how to completely alter our consciousness. And yet the only way that they can break people is by inserting a dildo into your ass.
He's getting buck broken.
Oh, that's
what's happening. He's getting broken.
No, and that doesn't happen. It's just,
it's happening here. It's happening live on this show. And they knew that he would have to deal with this damage, and this damage would unfold slowly over the years to come. This was his last regression before he... Imagine that being your last hypnotic regression. Like, you go in to have your life problem solved and then you come out like, oh my God. Just limping out of the therapist's office.
I can't laugh. I'm laughing at the... It's actually, on some level, it feels extremely absurd. Like, it feels like... I can't put my finger on, and perhaps when you describe more, I will. There's something going on with this guy that I don't think is abduction. Like, it's not that.
Yeah, well, this was his last regression before leaving the United States, and he went to study music in the Netherlands, which I'll get up to in a moment. But there's bizarre stuff that follows this. So he becomes completely nihilistic. He becomes completely terrible at school. His grades, he used to be a straight A student. His grades suffer. He can barely understand anything anymore. He just goes home and like screams at the wall. It really ruins him. And he actually says, because in his mind, he's like, when this happened to him, he's like, that was an insane, really bad drug trip. But he was acting like someone who was actually traumatized by rape.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. It sounds to me like what's actually happened here, and, you know, I was criticizing his personality, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe he actually was raped.
I think he was.
And the only way, and he wasn't raped by extraterrestrials. He was raped by someone possibly close to him. And the only way that his mind, his psyche can deal with this is to create this elaborate manifestation.
I don't agree with that necessarily. I think that when you take psychedelics and when you take mind-altering drugs, it's not a simple, like you're about to explain with the
astral entities.
With the astral entities, what happens with our thoughts?
Well, they're called wildlife.
When you take a psychedelic, your consciousness enters another dimension. You have access to realms that are normally sealed off from you and cut off, perhaps cut off for a reason. And when you open yourself up, you are now available to be interacted with by intelligent beings in other dimensions. Mm-hmm. And what those beings do to you is often outside of your control. And often people are told in psychedelic experiences that you have to surrender, you have to go with the flow, you have to give in to it.
But then why would they do something that it appears to be so human, so physical? Like, if you're in the astral realm, why would they rape him?
But this happens all the time. Think about succubus, incubus, shadow people experiences. The mix of sexual activity and altered states of consciousness is a constant undercurrent in all of this activity.
You're right. There is a lot of sexual elements that come up in these stories that, yeah, actually, you know, could be akin to rape. You know, it's truly horrible. And this is why particularly succubus and incubus experiences are as terrifying as they are and traumatizing. But then you hear, you know, other stories like what we were only recently describing of the tubes being inserted to extract, you know, energy and life force from people.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it's difficult. It's like really difficult to, I don't really believe, this is the thing though, I don't really believe that that's what's occurred to this guy because he's had a whole lifetime of other experiences.
If he hadn't been on mushrooms, I would be more inclined to go, yeah, it's some reconstruction to cover a real trauma that happened to him from someone close to him.
Let's not forget the acorn. So has he had a lifetime, and this can happen, has he had, sadly, a lifetime of abuse from a family member or someone close to him, and all of it has been turned into this?
There's nothing sexual about the acorn. There was nothing, like, there was nothing about
being. But maybe it is. You know, like the use, like, it's very phallic in the description of, you know, long needle-like things being stuck into him. You know, the acorn having an opening and going down over his finger.
I think we're stretching a lot here. It's a bit of a reach to try and...
Maybe
put this into a neat little box. So let me continue. He has all sorts of weird experiences after this event, like when he's still a teenager and going into his early 20s. He goes to movies. He tells this event where he jumps in a car, sits in the back with this girlfriend, and there's another couple who are driving to the movies. And he and the girl in the back can see this UFO. It's like this weird, almost odd, like odd teardrop shaped craft glowing in the sky, and he's like, what the hell is that? And she's like, well, are you seeing that too? And no one else in the car, the two in the front, don't even pay attention to it. And he watches this thing the whole way to the movies. It's flying over a reasonably busy street with other cars driving. Like, no one seems to be paying attention to it, but this other girl in the back seat can see it as well. He gets out, they go to the movies, and he's just, he has to say something. He gets out, and in like the line to the get into the theater, he says, what the hell is that thing in the sky? What is that? And this man behind him very angrily turns around and says, what's the matter with you? Have you never seen the Goodyear blimp? And he's like, he doesn't say anything because he's still this weird, insecure guy. But he's like, yeah, I have seen the Goodyear blimp, and that's not it. It's this crazy UFO in the sky, but no one else seems to be reacting to it. And when someone overhears him mentioning it, they get really angry. Like, this guy was really angry. And then he goes to the ticket booth, which is facing this object in the sky, and the woman selling the tickets doesn't mention it at all. And he goes in and sees the movie, and he has no memory of the movie. He just remembers coming out just going, why did no one else see that? And the weird thing about this is he... immediately after this, seeing this movie, that's the last time he speaks to these friends. That's the last time he sees them.
Yeah, because it sounds like he's having an acute psychotic episode.
He's not, though. The other girl saw it. The other girl in the back saw it. And like I covered on a previous episode, it has that feature with the Devil's Den story where these people experience something and then no one wants to talk about it afterwards. And they so don't want to talk about it that they actually stop being friends and stop talking to each other. And that's what happened with this group of friends. Now, it's a couple of years later, he's working at Blockbuster Video, and he's standing in line on his lunch break at Starbucks, and he sees a display of packets near the register, like plastic packets, and each packet has three little cookies in it. And the design of these cookies is the exact design of this UFO he saw that day. And you can look these up. They're called Madelines, like Starbucks Madelines cookies. They kind of look like little clamshells. If you just do an image search, you'll see. They're like little clamshell biscuits. We would call them biscuits. And years later, he was writing an online blog about this experience and how he saw these cookies, and that's the shape. And one of the commenters on his blog post said, have you ever read Proust? And he's like, yeah, well, I mean, I've heard of Proust, but I haven't really read Proust.
Who is Proust?
He's an author, a famous author. And he's got this novel called In Search of Lost Time. And in the story, the protagonist had become reacquainted with this deep level of involuntary memory after tasting a Madeleine cake. So this is this really strange really strange connection that there's this novel about tasting a Madeleine cake that brings back all these locked up hidden memories. And he sees this UFO that's shaped like a Madeleine cake. It's like this weird reference to Proust and this character with locked up memories. Throughout the whole thing, there's these bizarre psychological, like, archetypes going on, which aren't as clear cut as, oh, there's this weird shaped UFO in the sky. And what's extra bizarre about this day that he discovers these cakes? That day, he just randomly runs into that couple who were in the car with him that day he saw the UFO.
So he's experiencing synchronicities.
There's all these weird synchronicities, and that couple totally blows him off, doesn't want to talk to him, doesn't want to talk about it, and just basically leave. Now, at this stage, he's recently turned 21, and he wastes no time in becoming a full alcoholic because he was a mess. And as soon as he could get alcohol easily, he becomes an alcoholic. He drinks somewhere between 12 to 18 cans of beer every day without a break. And one day he's doing this for years. He actually has an epiphany that he's ruining his life and he needs to get help. So he books himself into Alcoholics Anonymous and he starts to get help. And he has a sponsor, of course. You with AA, you get a sponsor. And he starts calling his sponsor because he's seeing weird stuff in the sky. Like, there's these experiences where he's at his parents' old house and he sees this house in the distance that's lit up like a Christmas tree, and this thought is injected into his mind that he has to go and look at this house, which is like clearly not a house. It's clearly a UFO or something, but in his mind it's like, oh, there's a house over there and it's covered in lights. I need to go see it and invite myself in. So amazingly, because he's in AA, like most abduction scenarios, you just walk over there and get abducted or something, he calls his sponsor. And he's like, oh, there's a house and it's got all these lights and I need to go over there. I don't know why. And his sponsor's like, don't go over there. You'll probably find an excuse to start drinking. So he's like, okay, hangs up the phone and the house disappears. And he like gets out of this probable abduction scenario because he's in Alcoholics Anonymous. After this, he goes to a meeting. This is like a week later. And it's dark. It's shortly after 9 in the evening. He's stopped at a traffic light. And as the light changes, he starts to drive his car. And this dark shape scuttles from the brush, from the trees beside him. And this pterodactyl opens its wings and flies over his Volkswagen. And he's like, I shit you not. It was a pterodactyl. Like, it had the same shape. I could see the skin. I could see it's like membranous wings. It was huge. Like, the thing had a 14-foot wingspan. This huge pterodactyl flies up and I could hear the woof, whoosh, whoosh of the sound of it. I could see its legs dangling underneath.
He's a high-functioning psychotic.
I just saw a freaking pterodactyl. He's like, I did not tell my sponsor about that one. So later on at an AA meeting, and I'm just hitting some of the highlights here for the sake of time, but he has a spiritual experience. He's someone in AA points out, because he has so much anxiety about starting to drink again. It's like this constant terror that he's going to start drinking again. And someone at AA points out that means he's still an alcoholic. Like, even if you haven't drunk for 3 years, if you're still obsessed about not drinking, you're still an alcoholic. And this clicks something in his mind and he has total despair and thinks that he just basically gives up on everything that he's been holding on to.
He just sounds like a little bitch. I'm sorry, but come on.
He feels utterly wretched, like his life has no meaning. He's just, and I'm just like,
ugh. Stop being a fucking failure. Stop being a loser.
Which is really, to be honest, it's the theme that's been running through my head the whole time I've been, you know, reading this story. He's really just a massive loser.
Yeah.
Nothing, he can control nothing in his life. And something about this moment of complete surrender to being a massive loser, it transforms everything. He has this bizarre spiritual experience where he sees his body is made of all these light cords that are extending into space. And at the center of these light cords is this glowing orb of energy, which is his soul. Like, I won't get into all the details, but it's like this altered state of consciousness, spiritual transcendent experience, where suddenly all the despair, completely vanishes and he feels whole again. Like he actually loses the anxiety. He's no longer afraid and he's fundamentally changed. And I was looking into this a little bit and it's interesting because in the Alcoholics Anonymous literature, they actually have descriptions of this. It happens frequently enough to people that go through AA that they describe having spiritual experiences in the literature.
Is that a result of withdrawal symptoms?
It must be a result of the letting go, like you're letting go of everything. It's a result of complete
surrender. Yeah, it's like give up to it's an illness.
Complete surrender. AA has a very strong spiritual component as well. And even the founder...
Well, it's religious. It's not spiritual. It's a religious component.
Well, that's spiritual. So even the founder of AA writes about his own transcendental spiritual experience that happened to him. So it's interesting that it seems to be something that occurs because of the unique combination of the people. But this kind of changes his life, but he's still obviously a massive loser. So let me just quickly go through what happens after his 20s, where he kind of breaks this alcoholism. He gets married. He buys a grocery store with this woman. They divorce. He goes into bankruptcy. He then goes into a period of low-paying jobs. He works in retail sales, entry-level social work, to a position in a non-profit film production company.
I'll definitely play that loser sound.
That goes bankrupt. He then tries to revive a graphic design career he no longer cares about. And within a few weeks, he realizes this is futile and he doesn't really want to do it. Nothing feels right. He sees no opportunities anywhere he looks. Finally, he decides to go back to his parents' house and become a barista at a failing coffee shop. After a few years,
am I the only one that wants to punch this guy in the face?
He's had a tough life, all right. After a few years of that, he spends thousands of dollars to go to culinary school and then proceeds to get fired from every single job he gets. Like he lasts about a week.
You know what? I wonder, maybe, I mean, I'm no psychologist. Maybe this guy that was suffering from borderline personality disorder. They have these issues where no matter what they do, they fuck up their lives.
Yeah, so this is all going to coalesce into some kind of picture at the end. So stay with me. Because during this time, he's doing baking and pastry in upstate New York in like his seventh job that he's about to get fired from. And he sees an ad in a British music magazine for a course in sound design and experimental composition. It's at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And something about it is making him think, I need to do that. He's got no experience in music. He's arty, like he does film and stuff like that. But for some reason, he's like, I need to do this course. I need to drop everything and do this course. But he's still got a bit of logic. He realizes he's sunk thousands of dollars into trying to train to be a chef. And he's like, no, I've got to stick out this course, even though I hate it and I hate cooking and I hate everything. Now, a few years later, he's got some other job in a ski resort in Utah. And he sees a different ad in that same music magazine. And this is for a one-year course in experimental music in the Netherlands. And this one, for some reason, will not budge from his psyche. It firmly implants the idea that he has to drop everything, quit his job, and fly to the Netherlands and do this course. Now, it just so happens that his mother had recently passed away and he had quite a bit of inheritance from her.
That's what I was thinking. Where does he get all the money from to fund this?
He's a broke loser. So he takes his inheritance money and in the late summer of 2018, he moves to The Hague and starts this incredibly obscure course in experimental music. Like, talk about an expensive course that will get you zero prospects of employment. That is the epitome of zero prospects of employment, is a course in experimental music in Holland. No. So he goes to this, and a lot of the courses are like heavy math stuff, which he can't really get his head around. But this is where this story comes together. While he's in one of these lectures in the Netherlands on experimental music, one of the instructors, as a random aside, starts talking about this Danish company called Bruhl & Kjær. They make precision sound measurement devices for industrial and military use. And you can look them up. They're known as B&K.
For acoustic weapons or just for sensors?
They build acoustic sensors. They build power amps to run like acoustic generating machinery. They have
It is for weaponry.
They have military contracts. So if you, I might put them in the show notes, but if you look up B&K Audio, there's like some American hi-fi brand. It's not them. They're this Danish company, a few results down in Google. They've been running since the Second World War. Their story is they bought up a large supply of surplus military paint and started making specialized esoteric equipment with this military paint. And the paint has this distinct bluish-green hue to it. And that's the color of the faceplates of all their gear. And it's been their hallmark. It's like their signature. Now, the instructor points to a few of these vintage devices on the shelves in his lecture hall. And they're in their display cases. And they're these retro audio gear. Metal boxes, large dials, VU meters, tubes. And they all have the faceplates with that color.
So he had a premonition?
Remember that scene in the dentist chair with that giant praying mantis. He describes this room, and on all the shelves in this room are these old school vintage devices with VU meters, tubes, and they all have that blue-green paint on the faceplates. Every single device in that room from being a kid with that giant praying mantis was from this company, B&K. And for some reason, he sees this magazine while doing culinary work in New York in his 40s and suddenly realizes he has to go to the Netherlands to do this stupid course where the lecturer tells him about this audio company, B&K, and he's surrounded by these machines that he saw in his abduction as a kid. What is going on? It gets weirder. He starts researching B&K. He discovers, as I said, they've been a long time making military equipment. They have all these military contracts. One of their clients for years is Boeing. Why is Boeing important? Well, Boeing is involved in some pretty heavy military stuff.
Yeah, as in advanced the military weaponry, industrial complex stuff.
A lot of things we don't know about.
Space weapons.
Well, guess who Brian's father worked for decades?
Boeing.
Boeing. His dad worked at Boeing. Not only did his dad work at Boeing, his dad was in high upper level management on the in the sector of their military contracts. Do you see the picture that's starting to form here? Not even to mention this strange trend with abductees.
Well, it is consistent.
Whose fathers seem to be in either aerospace or the military. In some area, they're in the military-industrial complex. It happens time and time again. We always come across this. Now, his father never spoke about his work, would never mention it. He would tell his family he couldn't mention it. And after his father died, Brian actually found a copy of his top secret clearance documentation locked in one of his drawers in his study. So his dad was in this world, right? In this world of secret technology and high technology with the military. And if anyone would have a room full of these old B&K machines in the early 70s when he had this weird experience in the dentist's chair with a praying mantis in this room, it would have been at Boeing, his father's employer. So he implies this strange link, which you might be building in your mind right now. This link between this very particular brand of audio test equipment with his father's secretive military-related past in weapons technology. And he says, it's tempting to connect the dots in the following way. In some room, buried deep within this massive aerospace firm, there was an experiment involving the child of an employee who was sworn to secrecy, conducted by a giant, hyper-intelligent insect. During that experiment, the idea of fundamental research into sound for some unspecified reason was implanted, and that idea would develop over the entire lifetime's work of that child. There is the nagging sense, he says, that I have either enjoyed or suffered the intervention of non-human intelligent beings throughout my life towards some purpose for which I have just enough evidence consciously remembered that I can't dismiss it all as fantasy. He says there's a dreamlike quality to it all, but he can't write it all off. There's something going on. Now, he said in regards to his father's work, the only exception that his dad ever had to talking about his military work, and this actually came from his mother. His mother told him this after his father died. One day he confided in her that he met a man whose eyes had vertical slits for pupils. And apparently this meeting had upset him so much that he broke his code of silence. And he once asked his father if he had met this person in a Masonic gathering. His mother must have told him before his father died. Like, he asked him on his deathbed, like, where did you meet this guy? Did you meet him at a Masonic gathering? Because it turns out his father was a Freemason as well. So now we've got, remember the scenario with the swirling smoke and the whole, like, initiatory experience of it all, like it's some kind of ritual. And it turns out his father is not only in aerospace, military aerospace, but he's also a Freemason. His father wouldn't discuss it. His father's like, we're not talking about that. No discussion. And denied it ever happened. So he says, but when he told him, when his father told him it never happened, he said there was something about the way he said it, like he's very resigned, very sad in the way he said it, like something about the secrecy had broken him, he said, either the meeting with this man with the slit eyes himself or the need to lie about it. He could tell there was something weird. So he's in the Netherlands doing this course on experimental music. And all of this, these connections start appearing with the B&K audio being in that room and everything is bizarre. But the maths in the classes, it's so hard, he can't actually do the course. Like, it's actually too hard. So he drops out of the maths classes and just starts booking time in their studios that has all this old school gear. And he starts experimenting with the music. And just as an aside, also in this Netherlands course, one of the lecturers shows him this film about an anthropologist who met these tribes people in Papua New Guinea and gave them a Polaroid. And the film was explaining how this Polaroid basically destroyed the tribe because
Their souls have been stolen or something.
No, they became obsessed with taking photos of each other. Like, they stopped going to get food and, you know, the women stopped doing things.
Oh, you mean they gave them a Polaroid camera?
Yeah, they gave them the camera, and they just became their life, as just taking photos. They forgot about living and feeding themselves. They became addicted to it and it basically destroyed the tribe. But there was this point in the film where the anthropologists were allowed to film this initiation ritual of a young man coming into adulthood. And it involved a lot of pain. And during this painful, whatever it was they did to him, one of the elders held the young man from behind to reassure him. And as a gesture of comfort, cupped the base of his skull in the palm of his hand. And it was the precise, exact, the exact gesture that had been done to him by those greys who had given him a horrible rogering in his closet. And he sees this connection of why am I seeing this? What is going on?
So he's literally in the closet.
Well, it all seemed deliberate, this situation. Like, everything seemed like a setup for him to see this ad, for him to go to the Netherlands, for his mother to give him this money. It seemed like it was all set up, like to then see that audio equipment and then to see this film with the gesture, like everything seemed deliberate. So anyway, he quits these maths classes. He keeps doing this course, but he books all his studio time. And in one of the regressions with that dentist chair and all that audio equipment with praying mantis, in one of them, he heard something essential to the creature's nature. He heard a combination of tones, this simple four-note chord made from uninflected sine waves. It's a dry sound, he says. It's not beautiful, nor not beautiful, but it was somewhat frightening. In his recent stint at this course in the Netherlands, they had all this vintage gear. And what does that old B&K vintage gear do? A lot of it creates sine waves. And the boffins at this music place, they create all these old vintage sine oscillators and they kind of hand make like modular synthesizers where you combine all the signals and then you modulate the frequencies to create tones. And that's essentially the very early beginnings of electronic music as people figured out how to modulate these sine waves. So he starts booking the studios there and he starts using this old equipment to try and experiment with those tones and the principles of that sound he heard in that experience with the praying mantis and understood that it was something essential to their being. There's something about those tones that make up, like our bodies are made of, you know, carbon. It's like there's something about the sound that makes up the constitution of the praying mantis. And he starts experimenting with these frequencies on this semitone scale, kind of sounds in between the keys on a keyboard, he says. And he says he started to notice that when he tuned to different like oscillations of these sine waves on this old B and K gear, he was going into altered states of consciousness. He was going into weird trances. It was doing something to his body and his mind. And it started to fascinate him. He said, I would come out of the studio buzzing, disoriented, feeling precarious, but alive, sensing that I was getting close, he said. I was getting close to something. If I could never say close to what exactly. He says, in my trance state now in the therapist's office, I was making an explicit connection between this level of sound research and the mind of the creature. So it's like decades of, yes, being a loser with no direction in life. He believes all of this was because he was only directed, whatever was implanted in him as a child, was directing him to go and figure out this thing with tones and sine waves and sounds. It was something that this giant 9-foot-tall praying mantis wanted him to understand.
Okay, cool. Like, let's say that that's what happened, right? Who gives a fuck? Like, what what does it do? What? Seriously, like, you've had this entire life of alleged interaction.
Nasty, yeah, like, nasty.
What
nasty.
Does it do? Does it make you important? Is it like this self-fulfilling, like narcissistic belief that you're such a wonderful person because you understand the tone? What's the point?
Thank you, Aaron, for stealing the point directly out of my mouth. That's exactly what I want to know. What is the point? And what are you contributing to the world?
Zero.
On your mission to understand the intelligence of a 12-foot-tall, hideous alien freak in another dimension.
Rapist alien freak.
Rapist.
In another dimension.
So he has a podcast. Brian Short has a podcast. It's not really, he calls it a podcast. He puts it out. It's on Spotify. I'll link to it in the show notes. Every episode, it's bi-weekly, is about 30 minutes of him noodling with these frequencies to essentially try and unlock whatever his life quest was, to unlock the tones of the essence of an alien being. So let's take a listen. This is what it all boils down to, Aaron. This answers your question. What is it all for? This is the life's work of a genius. Let's take a listen. Are you feeling it yet? Are you feeling the contribution to humanity?
No, he sounds like he's just an experimental musician who's created this elaborate backstory to explain his unusual music.
It's funny though, like if you listen to the start of that, that's the like movie kind of sound that I expected to hear when that hideous praying mantis turns to look at you and you feel the depths of its horrible psyche, like a...
Yeah. But again... So what?
Maybe it gets better in one of the other ones. So a little bit nicer. That goes for 29 minutes. 29 minutes of this. Now, I imagine if you sat down in a room with headphones on and did actually go through 29 minutes of this, you would come out a little bit discombobulated.
Well, I mean, these headphones are very dull, so obviously because of the way we record, so perhaps I'm not picking up the higher notes here. But I would imagine that it's kind of got like a weird, not hemi-sync, but it's along those lines, right?
Right. There's another one. This is a completely different track. Skipping ahead. Let's go to 28 minutes in. No.
No. But what does he have any suggestions as to, like, if you sit down and you listen to this for 29 minutes, half an hour, what is it supposed to do anything?
No, he doesn't mention any of that in the copy that's associated with the podcast. He just says you should try this with headphones. But in the context of his memoir here, you know, obviously this is connected to these horrible, horrible traumatic experiences he's had throughout his life. And my question is, why would you want to associate with that? Why would you want to put that in your mind? Why would you want to listen to that? Why would anyone want that?
Because for some people, if they have experienced, and I'm not saying that he has actually experienced what he's saying. I think he's built up these false memories around something that has genuinely traumatized him. But for some people, kind of a relief from pain comes through pain. You know, so they keep on going over it and they keep on, you know, manifesting those same feelings because that seems to be able to, for whatever in this inverted psychological way, allows them to relieve that pain.
Yeah, I get that argument. But what you're doing is you're giving the world more of your pain. You're giving the world ugly things.
There's nothing beautiful here. You're right.
Exactly. You're creating ugly things. Mm. Ugly, dark, low level, destructive works that don't elevate human beings.
That's exactly what you're right there, though. This whole, it's all low level. Like this kind of tone and these sorts of sounds, this is what people describe in low level astral realms.
Create something beautiful. Go beyond.
That's higher level.
Go beyond.
Yeah, overcome.
The rapist, 8 foot tall praying mantis that destroyed your childhood. Go above it. Leave it behind. Don't indulge in darkness. Don't base yourself with such low, disgusting, dark, horrible things. Don't fill your world with those things and you'll see how things change. You start filling your mind with higher things, good things, beautiful things. Watch how your life changes. That's my takeaway from this. And the only other weird thing that happens is, you know, there's a bunch of other stuff. Like eventually Kit continues with the regressions and he has like past life regression, like past life visions of being a victim of the Stasi in... No, not Aaron's making rude gestures. Nothing like that. That's very rude.
I don't know what you say.
Nothing up the bum in previous lives. But he's like a victim of the Stasi in East Germany. And there's some interesting stuff with his past lives. The only other weird thing...
So hang on. Has he been a loser through each and every lifetime? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know if that counts as being a loser. But the other weird thing that happens is he starts seeing military aircraft after he makes this connection with his father and those past childhood memories. He sees like a perfect triangle craft fly silently directly over him. And it's almost like it's meant for him after he makes this connection. It's like a perfect wedge-shaped stealth craft.
Is he suffering from gang stalking?
No, nothing like that. He doesn't have any other symptoms that would be included in that. And then he sees an old military jet, like something from the 60s, like something from the Vietnam War. Again, like flying over near his car, but it's silent and it's way too slow. Like it's almost like it's floating like a balloon, but it's like a 1960s military jet. And he swears it's something else. So there is still some weirdness going on with after he made this connection with his father's work. But what it all means, I still don't know. But again, my takeaway is I understand that you want to try and figure out the meaning of all this and that you feel like you've been set on this path, but you can choose not to dwell in darkness. You can make a decision. you can make something beautiful.
Some people don't want to leave that darkness, though, Ben, because there's a certain comfort in that darkness for people as well, in what you know.
I'll link to his podcast in the show notes so you can blast your mind with Mantis energy.
Does he ever say anything or is it just
these tracks? It's just tracks. It's just music. It's like he's released an album without making an album. I don't know if there's much of a market for 30-minute long droning sounds of Mantis energy.
So again, at least if you slap like,
stop being a fucking failure, stop being a loser. Well, I mean,
tack on like a, what is it, 489 hertz frequency claim, and then maybe you'll pull in some people from that kind of genre. Do something. Maybe.
Anyway, that's a wrap. Let us know what you think is going on with The Seventh Dead, a memoir by Brian Short. I actually enjoyed it. He's a good writer. It goes to a weird place, but fascinating story. Do check it out at Amazon. It's available on Kindle now. And that's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Coming up in our Plus extension, really looking forward to hearing about the astral implications of our thoughts.
Well, it's the astral wildlife that many people experience. And, some of the entities that people encounter are just truly terrifying. We also come up against these threshold guardians, but they're not thresholds in what we would believe or what we talk about, you know, stopping people crossing over into a barrier. They're actually part of this whole idea of thought generation and creating entities that sit as you pass into these realms. And they might be coming from something internal. They might be coming from you. Yeah.
All that's coming up for our Plus members. If you want to get access, you know the drill. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. It's only $9 a month and you can help support your favorite show. You get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday and you get exclusives that come out every single Tuesday. There's an entirely concurrent running season exclusive to Plus members. Plus members also get a higher quality version of the show, higher audio bitrate, and you also get a totally ad-free version of the show as well. And if you upgrade to our MU Max plan, you get access to our entire back catalog and you can go through our, what is it, 15 years worth of shows?
Lost count.
15 years worth of shows. What a deal. $15 for 15 years worth of work.
Stop asking us for, you know, oh, I remember you guys did a story about a guy that did a thing. I have no recollection. It's not there. Just go back to season one, episode one, and start listening from there. You'll find it eventually.
When someone asks me about an old show and I try and think of it, my brain is just like, it's just a smear. It's just a blurred smear of information. I can't pull out specific things unless it's written down.
That's me with last week's episode, let alone what we did bloody 10 years ago.
That's a wrap for this free edition of the show. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us.
Sorry, we're having a little bit of a laugh there in the break as we were.